Okay, thank you. As Steve indicated, the organizers approached me with a somewhat unusual suggestion that I try to actually explain what I'm talking about. So I cannot flip through 20 transparencies in 20 minutes as I did in Bombay, and instead take two talks to cover them. And well, not exactly. In fact, I'm not yet totally sure what I'll be talking about next time, but this is the more introductory version of the subject. So I will start with some lightning review of ADS-CFT, and then review the D3 brains on the conifold and the SEN cross SEN dual gauge theory, and then we'll discuss RAPD5 brains and how they help to define the dual of SEN plus M cross SEN theory, and talk about the warped conifold and the RG cascade, which are the two novel phenomena which you can see from the ultraviolet end of the theory. And then the infrared dynamics reveals an interesting feature that the presence of these fractional grains happens to deform the conifold, and the deformation is a well-defined operation, which I'll explain. And this turns out to encode the chiral symmetry breaking and confinement of the dual gauge theory. So I think this is an interesting phenomenon because it helps to kind of geometrize a thing that we know happens in the field theory, namely that chiral symmetry can be broken. And here it's somehow encoded in how you resolve the singularity. First, you see that the solution where the symmetry is enforced just happens to be singular and therefore unacceptable. And in the search of acceptable solutions, you find that chiral symmetry must be broken, at least at zero temperature. And I might mention actually what happens at non-zero temperature in the next talk, but I won't talk about it today. So there is a host of both infrared and ultraviolet phenomena which are contained in this warped deformed conifold solution, and I'll probably stop around here and continue next time. So just a very brief review of the ADS-CFT duality, just to set up notation. I apologize to those who have heard my talks, so you can go to sleep in the familiar part. But basically the idea is, as always, is to stack D brains, and so we will have some stacked D3 brains, which are presumed to be dual to this metric of the extreme L3 brain, which has this very simple form with a single work factor which depends on the radial coordinate. So it's basically a work product of R3, 1 contained in this part of the metric and R6, which is a transverse space contained in this part of the metric. And this formula will reappear several times in the talk because it turns out that in more complicated cases, and even with fractional brains, this single warp factor formula will still persist, even though we replace the transverse space by more complicated spaces. Okay, so you all know the basic gist of the story that, as suggested by Maldacena, as you go to small radii, you actually go to the infrared of the gauge theory on three brains, which is the NECO4 superangles theory. And that's supposed to be dual to the throat limit, which is ADS 5 crosses 5. And you obtain very precise information about this theory. You can, for example, relate the radius to the Young-Mills coupling, and you see the appearance of this famous Hoft coupling here, which tells you that the gravity limit becomes reliable precisely at strong coupling. So you get some novel information about the large 12th coupling limit of the theory. And as one always wanted to see, the loop corrections are suppressed by powers of 1 over n squared. And the string sigma model corrections are suppressed by inverse powers of the 12th coupling. Okay, so now So this is the story if you stack brains at generic points in space. Now what has been suggested almost immediately after the basic ADS-CFT formulation was that you learn a bunch of new information by stacking brains at the tips of cones, okay? And this is what people sometimes call cone brains. So the simplest cones are just orbifolds of R6, okay? I have many experts in this audience who know more about this than I do. But it's basically, you end up dividing the phi sphere by some discrete subgroup of the SU4 rotations. And that replaces basically the S5 by some orbifold. And of course, the space would still be locally S5, so it's another Einstein manifold. And it turns out to correspond to a different gauge theory, and these gauge theories were studied early on for brains at orbifold points by Douglas and Moore, and they typically have product gauge groups. For example, the simplest n=2 supersymmetric ZK singularities will give you some SUN to the K type gauge theories. And we'll see that similar story can reappear in case of more complicated singularities. But this story is even more general than orbifold, because what we know is when people constructed this ADS-5 cross S5 solution, you immediately realize that the solution doesn't depend on this. It only depends on the phi sphere being an Einstein manifold. So if you replace the phi sphere by some other Einstein manifold, the gravity solution is still fine. And then it's a task to figure out what is the dual field theory. And for that, as far as I know, you always need to go back to this picture of cone brains, of brains at the tip of the cone. Okay, so not surprisingly, you see that the metric is basically the same, except you replace the metric of this angular space, you write it in place of the sphere metric. Fine. So you see that the same scalings apply, and then the throat limit, you obtain the ADS-5 metric times the metric on the Einstein space X5. And the modified version of this ADS-CFT correspondence in this case will be that type 2B theory on this background is dual to the infrared limit of the Sirian MD3 brains. And of course, the reason you know it's CFT is we're all familiar with the fact that the conformal symmetry is geometrized in the fact that you have an ADS-5 factor. So this is the universal factor. And the degree of supersymmetry is encoded in the number of killing spinners in X5. So X5 will generically break some or all of the supersymmetry, right? And the maximal supersymmetric space is the 5 sphere. So it all hangs together very nicely. And then, so once you obtain this story, you can compute various observables, like you can relate from the dependence of the action on the boundary behavior of the fields, you can compute correlation functions of some operators. And here, the one slight subtlety is that there is some, so this is, of course, a well-known story. But it turns out that there is some ambiguity in how you identify operator dimensions for sufficiently negative mass squared, okay? Because essentially what you find is that the boundary behavior, the small z is the large R behavior in ADS space, the boundary behavior of the field has two terms, one containing z to the delta and the other containing z to the d minus delta. So usually it's this term that's identified as the source and this term that's identified as the expectation value. But there are cases when you have to reverse this identification. Okay? And this is similar to some old story about right and wrong dressings and Louisville theory. So here it's possible to actually have what people called wrong dressings in the old days. And so when you look at this formula, you see that there are, of course, two solutions for the dimension in terms of the mass. But for positive mass squared, one of them is quite nonsensical because it will give negative dimension. And we know that in unitary theories, the dimension is bounded from below. But then the same reasoning tells you that there is something wrong with always picking the positive branch, because then you would conclude that the dimension is bounded from below by d over 2. So in four dimensions, you would conclude that you can't have dimensions below 2, and this is just manifestly wrong. In fact, the unitarity bound is not d over 2, but d over 2 minus 1. So, and in fact, this does connect with an ADS story, which was discovered ages ago by Brighton, Lochner, and Friedman, who noticed that there are basically two acceptable ways to quantize the theory with the mass squared, which is in this range. So this is this Brighton, Lochner, Friedman stability bound. And if it lies between here and minus d squared over 4 plus 1, you actually can take either sign of this, either branch of the square root. And that shows that indeed delta minus can go all the way down to d over 2 minus 1, which is the true unitarity bound. And the interest in this is not totally idle, because for this model that I will discuss, there actually are operators which rely on this delta minus dressing.
In this case, in this small range, if you increase the mass, you decrease the dimension of the operator.
Right. Yes.
So in this range, you can choose either, and both corresponds to
yes,
persons and operators.
Right. It turns out that for this model that I'll discuss, there is an operator of dimension 3/2, and then there is a super partner of dimension 5/2. Both of them correspond to the same mass squared. Okay? And one corresponds to negative dressing, and the other one corresponds to positive dressing.
Who corresponds
so if you
to
choose...
Who corresponds to the delta?
Yeah. What corresponds to the delta?
The other thing. You just interchange the two.
So you can always choose one or the other, and one's the opposite.
Right,
the
right.
Event.
Yes, yeah. So basically, these two, there is some ambiguity in whether you identify phi naught. So usually there is no ambiguity, but for some range of delta, there is actually an ambiguity, and you can interchange the meaning of phi naught and A. Okay? And in fact, that's how you compute the correlation functions. You have to Legendre transform. And this actually is very similar to something that I did ages ago in the matrix model also to change the dressing, because it turned out that I found that you can redress the operator, change the branch of dressing by Legendre transforming. And that's what you end up doing here. And it gives precisely the right correlation functions. This is worked out in this paper I wrote with Ed.
So is the statement that there's a different dual field theory for each possible choice of what's the operator?
No, it turns out that usually in the cases that we know, supersymmetry requires that we pick a very definite set of branches, okay? And we don't know how to change the set of branches. So if we just happen to reverse one of them, it would be a non-supersymmetric choice. And I'll in a second, I think it will become very concrete, because I'll show the operator where.
And you don't think it's a non-supersymmetric field theory? You think it really just didn't?
Maybe it's not. Maybe it just doesn't exist. I don't know. I'm not sure about the answer. Okay, so let's discuss. So let me move on to the specific example, which will correspond to n equal 1 supersymmetric theories on brains. And this is the simplest singular non-compact Calabi-Yau manifold, which is known as the conifold to physicists, and I guess as the quadric to mathematicians. It's defined by this equation and four complex variables, sum of z squared equals zero. It's a very simple space where basically everything is known explicitly, including the metric. And we know that Calabi-Yau space break supersymmetry to 1/4 of what it originally was. So before you insert the brains, you'll have 8 supercharges instead of 32, and then the brains break additional half, so you'll have n equal 1 supersymmetric theory. And the base of the conifold is precisely the space that will be, you know, replaced as 5 in this construction. And it's known as T11. It was known to supergravity experts, especially Romans, since the 80s. It has the structure of a coset space as U2 cross S2 mod U1. And you can also think of this space as a U1 bundle over a product of two spheres. So the metric on this space can be written explicitly. There are these two spheres, and then there is this extra U1 coordinate. And you see that it has a non-trivial set of basically magnetic monopole numbers with respect to each of the S2s. So it's a very explicitly known space, and we also know its topology, as I'll mention in a second. So this is no mystery. I mean, this can be read off from old supergravity literature.
That's 1 over 9?
1 over 9, yeah, 1 over 9. And this is 1 over 6. Right, so the question is, what is the dual field theory to this ADS5 plus T11? We expect it to be some N equal 1 superconformal field theory. And to construct it, it really helps to go back to this picture of cone brains, to stack 3 brains at the tip of this conifold and to go from there, because otherwise it's not totally clear what this field theory would be. So now let me just discuss a bit this conifold. So it has these 4 complex variables, which I'll combine into a vector. And you can rewrite them in terms of real and imaginary parts, x and y. Then this equation, z squared equals 0, implies x squared equal y squared, and x dot y is equal to 0. So now if you want to find the base, and this means that you are looking at a given distance away from the apex, right? So it means that you have to fix the absolute value of this 4 vector to be rho squared, say, which means that x squared plus y squared is equal to rho squared. That, in turn, combining these equations means that the absolute value of x and y are both fixed, okay, and x dot y must be 0. So from here, you see that this defines an S2 bundle over S3, because, for example, first you look at the set of points x, this is an S3, and then at each point x, this condition will select an S2, right? So it's an S2 bundle over S3, which is actually trivial, so this space is topologically just an S2 times S3. Okay, now... Well, x squared, so there are 4 x's, right?
Yeah,
so sum of x squared is 1, basically.
Yeah, so that's the S3.
That's the S3. Now you have this condition x dot y is 0, right?
Oh, okay.
So this this cuts out one of the dimensions.
Yes.
Right. But which it is, it kind of rotates, right?
Yeah,
but But there is no non-trivial topology here. And so you will get an S2 times S3. So now, and it's a singular space where basically at each radius there is this S2 cross S3, and both of them shrink to 0 size at the tip of the cone. So it's a singular space. And this is really the secret why it's so useful to us, because you can take a brain and wrap it over an S2 at any radius, basically, and place it there, and think of it as a domain wall. I mean, it might not be a stable configuration, but it was helpful for us to think in these terms. So now, when you look at the deformation, so there are 2 ways to resolve this singularity. One is called the deformed conifold, and the other one is called the small resolution. And this is a very poor man's sort of story, but I think it's a simple story. Now you change the equation to sum of z squared is equal to epsilon squared, and this is called the deformation. And now you see that the equation changes. So this equation will get modified to this one, okay? Which means that when y goes to 0, x has still finite radius, right? So at this point, when y is 0, you're just left with a 3-sphere, and S2 just disappeared, right? So the cartoon, or what happens is that asymptotically, of course, both S2 and S3 are expanding at the same rate. So asymptotically, this has the same geometry as before. But right near the tip, S3 only shrinks to some finite radius, while S2 smoothly shrinks to zero. So it's an R3 bundle. So this is local in R3. So you get an R3 bundle over S3.
Just
okay.
To
yes. Right.
Sorry, when you discussed before as an S2 bundle over S3, you chose X to be S3 and Y to be S2. You could have chosen.
I could do it the other way around here. But now it's now it's preferred. I mean, but of course.
So those two bundles are as a one. And you're using this picture.
Right.
So if I place the DC brains at any point on the default manifold, the goal to the new horizon limit, I just find in these factors as well. Any possible theory?
Yes, yes. I mean, because
it's a smooth space.
Right, right. Because it's a smooth space, it locally, so any smooth point will blow it up into ADS5 process 5. You really need to be at the tip of a cone.
Your existing epsilon is a real number.
Right. If epsilon squared is taken to be negative, then you just interchange x and y. Right.
It's a complex
number.
Yeah, but then you can just rotate. You can absorb it and into the, yeah, into the phase of z. Okay. So now then there is another story, which is the resolution, and the resolution will instead keep the S2 finite and shrink the S3. And the way you see it is you introduce this matrix Zij. So these are the new transparencies. I didn't know. Yeah. So you group them into this matrix and you see that. No. Who made this famous statement that transparency is never done? Anyway, so you can rewrite this equation, sum of zi squared equals zero is determinant of zij equals zero. Okay, so you organize things into this 2x2 matrix, and then you can kind of solve for these z's in terms of new variables a's and b's. Okay, because this equation is just z11 z22 minus z12 z21 is equal to zero. So if you write zij as aibj, then this equation, this constraint, quadratic constraint, is automatically satisfied. And this is sort of the trick towards linearizing the constraint, right? So these can be thought of as independent variables, and that's why these are the natural fields for the field theory on the D3 grain. So this story applies both to the unresolved and resolved case, and the difference is that, first of all, you identify A's and B's up to this U1 rotation, so they have the opposite charges under this U1, and you have basically to think of this as a gauge symmetry. And the second thing is that you impose this D-term type constraint, which is exactly the D-term constraint in the field theory, that sum of A squared absolute value minus sum of B squared is delta. Now for delta equal to zero, you find, so then the base corresponds to just fixing the equal absolute values. So now this is the two, three spheres, right? So A's and B's define each a three sphere. And you have this mod U1, which corresponds to this rotation. And you get, that's another description of T11, right, of the base of the space. But now if you make delta non-zero, then you find the resolved manifold, because when you take sum of B squared equals zero, then sum of A squared is still not zero, and it's an S3, but you have to divide by this U1. So you get an S3 mod U1, which is a two-sphere. So in this case, the S3 smoothly shrinks to zero, and it's the S2 that maintains the finite size. So, so one of the things that we asked ourselves was, what is the interpretation of the dual field theory of this resolution? And it turns out that, well, I'll come back to this in a second, but. Okay, so this A and B story suggests the construction of the field theory on D3 brains placed at the apex. So if you just have a single D3 brain, then you just promote these complex variables A's and B's into chiral superfields on the brain, and you make the gauge group U1 cross U1, okay? So A1 and A2 will have charge plus 1 and minus 1, and B1, B2 will have opposite charges. So under the diagonal combination, the fields are neutral, and you, as usual, have this free U1 that corresponds to the center of mass motion of the brain.
Can you remind us, so what's the idea behind promoting these to chiral?
Well, because it's... because these linearize the constraints, so they are unconstrained variables. I mean, intuitively speaking, you are trying to, before you had these six X fields, right? If you're at a flat point, then the transverse space is described by these six X's, right? Which are the fluctuations of the brain. And these six X's are the fields, right? Now you assemble them into three chiral superfields. A complex field. Now you've changed this transverse geometry. Now it's no longer described by these three complex fields, but it's described by these A's and the B's modulo the identification. And moreover, you need this D-term constraint, okay? So that's basically how Ed approached this problem. I mean, that's sort of the first thing that he said to me when we discussed it, is that it's a similar story to what you do in 1 plus 1 dimensions, right? And you, so this is the immediate guess as to how the theory has to be constructed in terms of these A's and B's with the U1 gauge symmetry, right, corresponding to this geometrical modding out of the U1 that I talked about, and this constraint of E core radii, which is the D-term constraint.
One person mentioned there are billions of ways of constructing Calamiales by
these type of
portions. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Is it just the simplest one, or is there a reason for not using other constructions?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you're saying, why isn't the story?
Well, you said all variables turns to zero. Mm-hmm.
But I thought you generalized it to other cases.
Yeah,
I mean, you and Steven. Yeah, I mean, one might hope that there are other examples.
So there's no comparison.
Right.
Is it generally going to be consistent with the normalizable field theory?
Yeah, this, I'll come back to this. This is sort of naively not consistent, right? But then, because you're looking at fixed points, then it...
Before you go beyond those resolutions, is it... You use different variables for each resolution. Can you see both resolutions with the same choice of parameterization?
No.
You have to, too.
No, and in fact, the deformation becomes... Yeah, I think that from the point of view of these variables, A's and B's, the resolution is much more natural than deformation. In fact, all that the resolution amounts to is giving expectation values to the A's and the B's, such that this constraint is shifted by some constant delta. So you just give classical values to the A's and the B's. The deformation from this point of view originally seemed to us like a very complicated story, because the reason is essentially that when you look at this theory, it has two gauge couplings, two UM gauge couplings. And to dial their difference, you need to put the integral of BNS through the two-cycle. But the deformed carnifold has no two-cycle topologically, right, because it shrinks to zero. So it really sits at the point where one of the gauge couplings is infinite. So if you don't have fractional brains, this deformation only happens in some sort of tensionless string theory, where, which is very hard to describe as a gauge theory. So without the fractional brains, I think the resolution is very easy. It just amounts to giving expectation values to A's and the B's.
So Igor, is it turning on a D term? You said A squared minus B squared is not zero for the resolution.
Right.
That's turning on a D term.
Yeah, so
far, yes. So it's changing the Hamiltonian, not the state.
Right, right.
Okay.
Yeah, so far this is the unresolved Carney fold.
Yes.
And if I resolve it, I want to add a delta here. And then I can only satisfy it if I give classical value, say, to the A's. Okay.
Yeah, when you first turn on the D term, then you add the variables term.
Right.
And it forces.
Mm-hmm.
But you will probably explain that this is this theory can be interpreted as n equals to theory with mass terms given to the scalars and maximals. Then it seems that the resolution is given rise to complex variables terms n equals to n.
Well, I was going to explain the relation to the n equal to orbifold default theory. Yeah. Okay, so maybe you can ask me again. Okay, so now, so you get this U1 cross U1 theory for a single D3 brain, and then the natural guess for the N3 brains will be UN cross UN with the A's and B's in this by fundamental representations. And then you notice that you really need an exactly marginal superpotential, and the theory has to be invariant under not just under the U1 R symmetry, but under this SU2 cross SU2, because the T11 space has this full SU2 cross SU2 symmetry. So there is actually a unique expression you can write down, and it happens to be quartic in the fields, so just perturbatively it's not renormalizable. But you have to think about it in the following way. First, you flow to a non-trivial fixed point where the fields have fixed anomalous dimensions. Basically, the dimensions of the A's and the B's become 3/4, and the R charge becomes 1/2. And at this fixed point, which is a Seiberg-type fixed point, this potential becomes exactly marginal. And dialing this potential basically gives you the freedom of essentially dialing the radius of ADS 5 or of T11.
Yes. I'm getting a little confused. I mean, so if you start with the conical fold and you put the brains at the singular point, you get this non-trivial field theory.
Right.
Now, if you resolve or deform, you know, however you want to get rid of the singularity first and then put the brains in, you get back just the trivial ADS 5 process 5 story.
Yeah, far in the infrared, but then you can still think about the UV theory as being this theory, right? Because asymptotically, it's going to approach ADS 5 cross T11. So once you've shifted the brains from the tip, you can think of it as a simple example of...
But you're not moving the brains off the tip, you're just changing the geometry that the brains sit in.
That you can also do. I mean, there is very little difference between moving them off the tip or resolving, actually. Both operations amount to giving classical values to the A's and the B's. Okay.
So they're physically the same?
They're very similar. Yeah, they're similar.
But there is a difference. Isn't there a difference in this question that Joe asked?
If you give equal expectation values to the A's and the B's so that this is maintained, then you think of it as moving brains away from the tip. If you say only give them to the A's, right, then there is an imbalance here which corresponds to adding a phi Heliopoulos. Yes, and that's a resolution. But but they're part of the same space of theories where you just take the same theory and give classical values plus this phi Heliopoulos term. Yes.
You changed a couple of terms as well.
Right, right. Yes.
Can I ask about what you were just saying? There was already a Yang-Mills gauge coupling at two and N. So didn't that already give you the information you needed to determine the ADS radius without adding this? I mean, you were saying that this lambda that you wrote down here is the thing that corresponds to the ADS radius. Why is it not just G squared N like usual? Or is it?
Well, there are some dimensionless, there are two scales, right? Scales of the two gauge couplings. I mean, this is a dimensionful parameter, so you have to take some dimensionless lambda. Yeah.
Wait, I thought you said at the end of the day, it's not, it's marginal, right?
Yeah, the bare dimension is there, and then there are these two scales of the two gauge groups, right? And then you can take, so if you think of it this way, then you can take dimensionless ratios of lambda to lambda 1 and lambda 2.
Lambda 1 and lambda 2 with the scales of the gauge
groups. Yeah, the scales of the gauge groups.
So there are exactly two exactly marginal operators, really?
Yes.
Two marginal combinations.
There are two marginal combinations.
And they map to what? One is RADS and one is...
And the other one is the integral of BNS through the 2-cycle.
Okay, yes. Fine. So, but if I understand this correctly, you're not really supposed to be thinking about this in terms of perturbative gauge theory.
Right,
you're
right.
On at some non-trivial point. The reason you're able to do an analysis that looks like perturbative gauge theory is because you have any plus one supersymmetry and certain things don't get renormalized.
That's right, that's right.
Super potential looks the same here as it would someplace else.
Yes,
So, now, what is the statement about what the free parameters are in field theory language? It's this coupling and some gauge coupling?
Well, I think there are two dimensionful scales. Like if the two gauge groups flow, right?
I'm confused. It's a conformal field theory.
No, yeah, but if you...
So there are no scales. There are just dimensionless parameters. And what am I supposed to think of those?
Yeah, from the conformal field theory point of view, these are just the two gauge couplings, G1 and G2.
Okay, and then lambda would be fixed at the fixed point in terms of those two.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, except, no, I'm confused, because if G1 and G2 are both very small, you would think you could do perturbation theory. So you must not be able to vary G1 and G2 in an arbitrary way and still have a...
No, if you have already...
you have to be at the fixed point.
There's this Strasbourg analysis that you have to do that says that there are three exact data functions, and you can show that there's a two-dimensional space of solutions.
Okay, but then the parameters aren't really...
They're not lambda G1 or G2. There's some complicated linear combination.
You can't go through the origin in the gauge coupling constants.
Yeah, not in the origin.
Doesn't go
in this three-parameter space. It's someplace away from the origin.
Yeah, if you start with this bare Lagrangian, then it's never weakly coupled.
Do we know how to discuss in the field theory what corresponds to the field and what corresponds to the ABS radius?
Yes, I think we have that identification. I mean, it's basically the same as in the n equal to orbifold theory. That the sum of the 1 over g squared, 1 over g1 squared, and 1 over g2 squared is the dilaton, or the, and the difference is this integral of BNS. Yes?
When you talk about the renormalization, are you taking n to infinity first and then discussing renormalization?
Yeah, in this business, I want to be in the Toft limit. I mean, that's the safest thing. So I imagine first the Toft limit and then the Toft coupling still can flow. Right? Well, I mean, I was...
So we think of n as being larger.
Yes. I was thinking, what I was saying was about this holographic RG picture where you have a space-time which interpolates between, say, ADS5 cross T11 and ADS5 cross S5, which you can construct just from the geometry of, say, these three brains moved off the tip of the conifold. Right, so asymptotically, it's one space. And
this is after you've done the resolution.
Even when I don't do the resolution, I can move the brains off the tip and get this. Or I can just do the resolution, in which case I'm left with an S2.
Okay, yeah. So you're saying that this exact conformal field theory also has a moduli space.
Yes.
And that if I move off on the moduli space, I can break conformal invariance in that way. And then
I can break gauge symmetry. I can break, basically, as you do this, you break SUN cross SUN down to SUN. But this SUN far in the infrared turns out to have n equal 4 supersymmetry.
So then you move off the
moduli space. You go off on the moduli space of the conformal field theory. That always breaks conformal invariance.
Yes, yeah.
All right.
And then you look at what happens in the infrared flow from that, and what Igor is telling us, you get a smaller gauge group, but a new conformal fixed point that happens.
Yeah,
so you're not moving along the marginal directions.
No, we're not talking about coupling constants anymore. We're talking about that.
So you turn us a relevant operator.
No, I'm not turning on any
other. No, you're just giving classical value.
It's giving at the fixed point, but the fixed point theory has, like n equals 4 itself,
yes.
It has a moduli space, which breaks conformal.
Okay, so it's not the one space of conformal theories.
It's a moduli space of this particular conformal field theory. Mm-hmm. It's not the line or the surface of fixed points
This is a nice point of contact between field theory and this holographic stuff because as when you move the brains off of this tip, you still know the metric, right? You basically can construct, once you know the green function
on the space,
you know the metric, and the metric will interpolate between, so far away here, it will be ADS5 cross T11. Cross T11, and around here you blow up the S5, right? So it will become n equal 4 SUN theory, and then you can compute the tails, so you can tell basically that you're giving expectation values to things like trace AIBJ, things like this, just from the tail end of the. From the perturbations that this induces around the ADS5 cross T11 metric.
So this is just
when you flow, now we can combine Nikita's question with this. Right? So when you flow, you started out, you have this conformal field theory which was part of a surface. You worked at a particular point on that surface.
Well, I think that strictly conformal point is when the A's and the B's don't have revs, right?
Yeah,
then you don't break them.
But now I can
move
away from that by going out along the moduli space, flow to another fixed point. Does that preserve the surface of fixed points that you had? In other words, could I have done that any place along the space of theories that I started from?
I think you can do it everywhere except for these truly pathological points where the couplings goes up.
The n equals 4 theory doesn't have as many marginal directions. Oh, you say it does. If I don't want to preserve n equals 4, want to preserve n equals 1, then I'm fine. Okay, good.
Yeah, can I just ask you one more question about the theory? So in the D-brain is at the tip of the cone. Mm-hmm. There's another excitation of that theory before you try and take the near horizon limit, which lives on the same co-dimension space as the three brains, namely the D3 brain of type 2b that wraps the shrunk three cycle.
Mm-hmm.
It's confined to the same plane, and therefore it doesn't decouple by any sort of volume argument when you go to low energies in the D brain system. So one might expect it to couple into this gauge theory.
Well, I think from my point of view, it's dual to an operator in the gauge theory, because if you
do you see that operator?
Yeah, that's the what we call Dibberian.
Yeah, I think you're talking about some heavy thing that appears in there.
But it is going to become heavy because after
I think it morally sits on the gauge theory side of the correspondence, I'm trying to ask.
I would say that if you first look at the stack of a large number of D3 brains, right, that's going to blow up the space, right, into a very large ADS5 cross T11. Now, in that space, you can add the wrapped D3 brain around the three sphere of T11, and that. Well, Steve and I looked at that, and that precisely corresponds to a...
I'm not sure that's the same thing.
But it's a BPS operator, so you should be able to trace it back to the D-brain side. I'm sure that its mass is...
Yeah, it is a chiral operator.
Well, on the D-brain side, in this full open plus D-brain, in the full theory, it's massless.
In the theory without D-brain.
Yeah, but the D-brains seem to do...
that seems to be in conflict
you
with
think,
the
so you think what happens is that the D brings
that seems to be the consequence of the duality. I was actually going to mention that, so let me move along a little bit. Okay, so
how do you know it's masked?
Before you put the
numerator in there,
it's not.
No, but it's in the field, right?
It's in the field of this
lot. The other ones, and because it's not flat, part of it is like an anti-numerator, so it's not.
Yeah, it, we would say that the field,
Before you add the other three brains, it's clearly not. And then
right, but after you've added this very strong field of the brains, I mean, because.
I mean, there's actually
five states that add the
So these A's and B's are bifundamentals, right? And you can form gauge invariant things like trace A, B, A, B, A, B, where, I mean, using the F-term conditions, you see that you need to symmetrize individually the I indices and the J indices. And you see that these must form the SU2 cross SU2 representations with spin K over 2K over 2, basically, with maximum spin. And they also have to have R charge K. And in the usual spirit, you want to find these from the spherical harmonics and T11. And it turns out to be very easy to find them. And one can actually do a very complete classification of all the modes in T11, which was done by the Tarina group. And it looks like there is complete correspondence. But one subtle point, which you immediately notice from the simple analysis, is that because the dimension delta, right, will be 3k over 2, for k equal 1, you do indeed get this negative dressing, right? That's sort of how we notice this, because 3 halves is less than 2. And so, and indeed, when you look at the corresponding scalar in ADS5, it has mass squared equal to minus 15 quarters, which is in this window, this Brighton-Lochner-Friedman window, and somehow, because this operator is protected by supersymmetry, so the supersymmetry requires for us to pick delta minus dimension for this guy. And then it has a super partner. So in fact, this n equal 1 multiplet contains also its super partner, which has dimension 5 halves. And that corresponds to exactly the same mass squared. So the multiplet contains two scalars of the same mass in ADS5, two conformally coupled scalars. And this other one must be picked with a delta plus dimension, okay? So this is sort of neat, and it's really amazing how this ability to pick the negative dressing saves you, because otherwise there would be something totally inconsistent.
The space is very efficient.
Right.
So the other theory, if it exists, would have all the same operators.
For example, if you chose to dress both of them with a plus dressing, it would just have a wrong dimension, because we know that the dimension, this is a BPS dimension, right? And the weird thing is that it only happens for this operator trace AB, but for trace AB, AB, its dimension is already high enough that you cannot, that it exceeds the bound. I mean, yes?
These representations of SU2 cross SU2 have the same spin with respect to both of them.
Right.
And the same representations that appear in hydrogen atoms that is the so-called symmetry.
So that's right.
Is that correct?
Well, that's because, yeah, indeed, these can be all built out of the Z's, right? The four Z's of the carnifold are, you know, the fundamental of SO4. And in some sense, these fields are all kind of built of tensoring, I think, the fundamentals of SO4.
Do you expect upper bound
from
the conformal dimensions?
Well, only at finite n, maybe. But I mean, I'm not sure about finite n issues. I mean,
no, but on
On the field theory, no, not at infinite n. No, I think. Okay, so now the other comment is that what Nikita already mentioned is that another way to view this theory, which also convinced us why the construction with this quartic superpotential makes sense, is that you can think of it as the endpoint of RG flow starting with this n equal to orbifold theory with mass terms. So the observation is it's easy to see that the set of fields you have in this theory is very similar to the set of fields you have in this n equal to orbifold theory. And the gauge group is the same. It's SUN cross SUN. And that theory also has the A's and the B's. The only extra thing that it has is the adjoint of the first SUN and the adjoint of the second SUN. So this immediately suggests that you've somehow mass deformed this theory and by adding masses to the fine phi tilde. But then, and moreover, you see that, so this S5 mod Z2 has a fixed circle, so it's a singular space. Well, T11 is a smooth space. So you somehow, by adding this mass term, you're smoothing out the fixed circle. So it has to be a twisted sector field.
So now can I ask my question again?
Okay.
So why can't we add the linear term in 5? Complex variable to resolve
the connection. Maybe you can. I haven't thought about this, but maybe. So you think that's what the resolution looks like? Okay. All right. So then the neat fact is that when you add this term with the minus sign, and the minus sign is precisely because it has to be odd under the interchange of the two gauge groups, and integrate out phi's, you get precisely the right superpotential. So the square of this term minus the square of this term gives you precisely this SU2 cross SU2 invariant superpotential. So here, this SU2 cross SU2 symmetry emerges right at the end point of the RG flow. And one can also study, for example, so this is a simple example of RG flow where you can also study, for example, how the central charge behaves, both using the holographic picture and using the field theory. And this was done by Steve Gopser, and he found that in both descriptions you find that it decreases by a factor of 27 over 32. So it's a kind of non-trivial factor. In the ADS story, it just comes from the ratio of the volumes of T11 and S5 mod Z2. Okay, and there is a more subtle anomaly calculation on the field theory side. Then the story about the wrapped brains. So now I'm going to move to the wrapped brains, which is the main subject. So since topologically T11 is S2 cross S3, the simplest thing you can do is just wrap the D3 brain over S3. And this is going to give you an operator of very high dimension because S3 is huge, right? So when you compute its dimension, because M times so L is the radius of space, and M times L is very large, right? So the dimension is approximately just M times L, right? You ignore this extra junk in the square root. And the mass is T3 times V3. The volume is easily computed from just integrating the metric, right? You know the metric. And you find that the dimension is precisely 3 quarters N in agreement with this proposal for the form of the operators. Because you can, we call them Dibarians because they are baryonic with respect to each of the two gauge groups. I mean, not to be confused with the doubly strange Dibarian that the nuclear physicists have been looking for. So here, you know, you take these scalar fields, multiply them, and because there is anti-symmetry with respect to both color factors, this operator doesn't vanish, right? And its dimension is 3 quarters times n because each A has dimension. So it's nice that it also comes out from this volume calculation. So I hope it answers Eva's question. Yeah. Okay, so now the more complicated thing one can do is to construct what seems like a domain wall where you wrap a D5 brain over the S2 and its remaining directions are along the D3 brain. D3 brain on there. Yeah, then you get what we call the fat string, or you get some sort of, I think it's not a DPS object, but it's a similar game that Witten played in. Right. The way you can see it is, the reason you can tell that this is BPS is that the powers of the coupling cancel out. All that is left is N. For example, if there was some remaining G squared N to the power 1/4, right, then it would be immediately a hint that it's not BPS, because
you can just slave those.
Yeah. Okay, so then the claim is that once you add these D5 brains wrapped on the S2, you will get a different theory. So you'll get a theory which has gauge group SUN plus 1 cross SUN. And this is essentially the fractional brain. I mean, it's a wrapped D5 brain. One can give a sort of, I mean, it may be obvious to some of you that this is the right gauge theory, but the argument that Steve and I gave was a bit roundabout. It had to do with the string creation by crossing brains. So basically, after you put this domain wall made out of a wrapped D5 brain and take this dibaryon and pull it through it, it turns out that there is a string creation. Because every time a D5 brain, which is completely orthogonal to D3 brain, when they cross, there has to be a string created. And the interpretation of the string creation is that there is an extra fundamental index on this operator, which just means that now you don't have SCN cross SCN, but you have SCN plus 1 cross SCN.
Since N is going to infinity, how are we supposed to think of this?
Well, you think of N as large. I mean, at the end, what we'll do is we'll actually look at many, many of such things, and we'll have SUN plus M cross SUN. We're both.
And are comparable.
Yeah, we can think of both M and N being large.
What was the question?
I think that Greg's question is how do you recognize real N from N plus 1 when it's large?
Because 1 over n is greater than 1 over n squared, which are the other corrections.
Well, maybe this is really good. So are you starting now with just the product of T11 and ADS5 and putting these brains in that?
Yes, now I'm just doing it as a probe. Right?
If it's a probe, then you're not changing the cosmological constant on either side of your sort of...
Well, that's a second order effect.
Right,
and
so
then
that's like the large effect here.
Yeah.
But
then I'll be doing it more exactly. For now, I'm just motivating why. So I have this picture, right?
But you could also use n plus 2 logic, right? So at the orbital point, we know what
yes.
the fractional brain squares.
Exactly.
We know what the gauge group
exactly.
is for finite
mm-hmm.
brain.
Yeah. Now that part I understand.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm trying to keep track of is where n is going to infinity and not, and that's why I'm confused by this.
Well, just keep it huge, but
SU infinity times SU
infinity.
N is huge.
Yeah.
So you
Taylor expand. Degrees of freedom.
Okay, so you can Taylor expand on the first factor, right?
Right.
Okay.
I mean, the what I'm after is basically that you have this cone, right? And the cone has a shrinking S2, right, and a shrinking S3. And first I inserted this large number of regular D3 brains that are sitting here.
At which point that's no longer a cone, right? This was something that had been confusing me. Now it's just, there's a throat.
Well,
let me
imagine doing it simultaneously.
Well, this is related to the issue of the conical transition and how you see
yeah,
that, whether
yeah.
you would see that
yeah.
at all.
So Eva, if you don't put that there, I guess what you get is the product of ADS5 cross T11, and so those two spheres and three spheres are staying fixed.
Right, so it's a throat, right?
Throat.
Yeah, one way to think about it is that you first do this, right, then you get this ADS5 cross T11. Then you add these wrapped brains over S2, okay, some number of wrapped D5 branches over S2. And then you see that they don't want to sit at fixed radius. They'll actually be attracted towards small r. That you can just see from calculating the force on them. So they will go here, and basically they will go to very small r, and they will do some, what we'll see is they do some violence to the space at small r. What you expect to see is that, of course, you know, once there are many of them and their deformation is not negligible, you don't expect to see ADS5 anymore. The space has to be deformed. So I mean, this is all not, you know, mathematically rigorous, of course, but it's essentially that you can engineer this SUN cross SUN plus M theory from N of these objects and M of these objects sitting at the tip of the conifold. Then you can just start with the finite numbers of them, N large but finite numbers. Then you just start using the basic ADS-CFT logic that you look for a solution with the Ramon-Ramon fluxes corresponding to both types of these brains, right? And this
solution
one...
solution implies with N and M both going with infinity.
Yes.
Some rate fixed ratio maybe.
That's right. But furthermore, what we'll see is that N itself stops being a constant.
Sure.
That's even more weird effect, that M is going to stay as a well-defined number, but N will kind of start flowing logarithmically.
In effect, they don't all go down to the tip. They're sort of spread out over the region near the tip.
That's not how I think about it. I think of them as just disappearing, period.
But
I think of them as...
It changes when you cross these, and M is evolving as you go out.
Well, isn't it? It's just the same thing that we always see. It's basically distances infinitesimally close to the brain get blown up. I mean, that's the scaling limit. So all of ADS is fitting in some infinitesimally small region of R in that picture.
Yeah, I prefer to think. Well, now jumping ahead of. So let me get to that point, and maybe we'll discuss it then. But I prefer to think of these brains. So first, these brains created the horizon and disappeared. Then these brains start heading towards very small r. When they get there, they again disappear, but deform the space appreciably, if m is large also. Okay, and then you end up with a nice metric. Yes, yeah.
But even one of them distorts it, right? Because
even one of them distorts it, right? But
there's more than n equals infinity. There's an asymptotic expansion. And it looks like one changes terms which are bigger than the first quantum correction.
Yes. Yeah, that's sort of what Nikita and I did. We observed that there is a 1 over n effect, which can be just computed in this probe approximation. So let me review that. Basically, then you say that what are these wrapped D5s doing? They're introducing M units of Ramon-Ramon flux through the S3. And then you see that there is an interesting 1 over n effect immediately, even in this probe approximation, that this NS and S2 form, which used to be a modulus and was constant independent of R, now has to depend on R. And it has a logarithm in it, which we interpreted as RG flow. And that's a really simple, purely probe calculation. And it comes from these Chern-Simons terms in the supergravity action. Namely, you have these equations, d star, this equals this. This is the basic equation. And you have to put in the right ansatz. You know, you have to find the harmonic forms on T11, because HRR has to be proportional to the harmonic 3 form, and BNS has to be the harmonic 2 form. That's easy to find. I mean, this is just the volume form of the first 2-sphere minus the volume form of the second 2-sphere times E psi, where this is this guy. Okay. So then when you just solve this equation, you find this logarithm. Okay, and this was a systematic approximation in 1 over n. It was an effect of order m over n, basically, because there are m of these and there is a 1 over n, so it's a term which can definitely be distinguished from supergravity loops, for example. Right. And And you see that it's exactly the same logarithm. There is, and this we interpret as the flow of 1 over g1 squared minus 1 over g2 squared that goes as m times log r. And these NSVZ beta functions will give you the same answer to leading order in m over n. Because you see that once you added this m, there is no way to satisfy both beta functions. There is a definite imbalance at order m over n. And this imbalance in the Toft couplings, right? When you divide by n, there is an m over n effect on the flow of the Toft couplings. Okay, and that's what we think we're seeing here, right?
You can check the coefficient.
Well, the coefficient, I think I can see the 3 in it. I have not fully checked all, I mean, it's sort of a pain to normalize everything. But there is this very weird 3, right? Because the 3 has to do with the dimension being 3 quarters. And there are also these factors of 3 in the metric of T11. And those definitely match. Yeah. No, there is in fact.
Weird factors of 3 in transcendence terms.
No, I actually checked that the 3 is account, this 3m is accounted for by that, but the extra 2 pi's and stuff I haven't yet checked. There are no fives.
Yeah, you don't know the gammas, right? So how are we checking here?
The gammas? The gammas, you know. You know the gammas at the fixed point, right? Yeah. The gamma is equal to minus 1/4, right? So at the fixed point it cancels. Very near the fixed point, what you know is gamma will be minus 1/4 plus something of order m squared over n squared. This is easy to prove. And this immediately gives you the definite term of order m over n.
How close are you to a stopping point? Because it's almost cookie time.
within 1 over n.
Well, if you want me. Do you want me to stop? I'll be happy to stop.
If there's an actual stopping point in about 2 minutes, then...
Okay, let me just get to the cascade, and then I'll discuss the deformation next time. I mean, there were a lot more questions than I expected, so... But I...
It'll only get worse.
Next time we have more time. So, as I said, and this approximation is where you just took this... idea. You haven't computed the back reaction on the metric, right? You've just computed these equations for the forms, but the metric is first corrected at order m squared over n squared, and Nikita and I didn't look at that. But then it turns out that it is possible to include that effect. So here the 3 is in place, and you see the 3 is related to the fact that, you see, the field strength has to be self-dual, right? And the self-duality condition forces this 3 to be here because of this factor of relative factor of 3 in the metric. So I wasn't entirely kidding.
What field strength? Not the Schwarz.
No, the
pi form?
Yeah. No, the star of H and S, and S is HR in this background. That's the secret of this background.
Oh.
So the complex 3 form is self-dual. That fixes the relative normalization of HRR and BNS. Okay, so, and that's why the dilaton doesn't run.
Why is there a duality series? You have T5s and no NS5s.
But there are components of, that's the trick, basically. That's the crucial fact that because BNS starts varying radially, okay? So you have this nice 3 cycle, and then there is a dual cycle which involves the S2 and the radius. And you induce exactly equal magnitudes of H. So HR has components in 1, and HNS has components in the dual cycle. And the relative magnitudes have to be exactly balanced for the dilaton not to flow, and the dilaton doesn't flow. The dilaton is constant.
So there's no brain source for the...
No, there are no... It's just a pure supergravity solution. There are no... But the fluxes are arranged in this funny way, because you see, once you added this, I showed that this logarithmic variation is induced by this equation of motion. And the remarkable thing is that this is exact, that this is actually an exact solution. And the exact solution is only obtained by modifying a little bit what the warp factor is. Okay, and then it's just exact. This has been checked by many people, so.
It doesn't go in classical definition, does it?
What?
It is not solution for the system, right?
It is? It's a solution with these fluxes. I mean, the...
why is it charged rolls for gradient in the
Well, that's what one of my tasks is, to try to explain this today. But this is just, this is an exact solution of supergravity equations.
Can you explain the physical reason why the charged rules can be
just I'll explain it. So at least one person hasn't heard my talk yet. Okay, good. But let me just say that this is an exact solution with a log. And one way to see it is that you'll actually notice that before you introduce this number m, the equation for, so you have this conifold, and the equation was box H equal to 0, where this is just a six-dimensional box. I mean, the box with respect to transverse coordinates. Now, what happens after you've introduced these m brains is that this will get a source, which is, I don't remember the exact factor, but I think it's m squared times gs squared over, I believe it's r squared or something like, or over r, something like that. And so the h is no longer a harmonic function. It has a simple logarithmic solution, okay? So once you make the radial ansatz, it's trivial to solve it. You find this log. And moreover, now what the other interesting thing that happens is that the components of BNS, remember that BNS sits in this dual cycle to HRR. So BNS wedge HRR is just the volume form on T11. So this extra term will now modify what you mean by F5. And you pick up an extra logarithmic term. So that means that the F5 itself is no longer a constant n, but picks up this extra logarithmic term proportional to m squared. Okay? And this is...
That's an equation of motion.
Yes, yeah, this is just follows from basically one way to see it is that df5 is h3 wedge f3. Right? This is one of the equations. Right? You solve it, you get this. Okay, so this log is clearly correlated with this log, and we know what this means. It means that this F5 measures the effective three-brain charge enclosed in a given radius, and of course also the warp factor measures this too, so it's really the same effect. So what this is telling us is that, and this is the first, I mean, of this kind example of these varying flux solutions, because you've added enough other fluxes that the five-form flux has started to vary, okay, which is a strange effect, but there are by now several such solutions, and you need to interpret what this means, okay? And if, so moreover, you notice that, remember that this BNS, it used to be a periodic variable, right? And now, when BNS goes through the period, because HR has a factor of m, it means that n effectively jumps by m units. So as you go to smaller radius, n kind of starts decreasing in jumps of m units. And what's the interpretation of that? So let me just try to suggest an interpretation. And
that formula for F5, so that's not an integer, right?
Yeah, I think...
So what about the rational integration?
Well, it needs to be... I think this F5 tilde... does not have to be. Well, first of all,
it's DC4, which is an integer.
Yeah, DC4 is an integer.
But if I have a five-brain mapping transfer space, it's going to be the integral of F5 that gives me.
Yeah, I think what happens is that it's a subtle and somewhat confusing issue, of course. But I think what happens is that this flow of BNS, I told you already that the flow of BNS corresponds to the flow of the couplings, okay? Because you interpret the integral of BNS as 1 over G1 squared minus 1 over G2 squared. So this flow of BNS for a while should be interpreted as just the flow of couplings in the given theory. But then what happens is that there is a divergence in the coupling, and this jump occurs as because of the divergence occurring. So probably, you can't see it in supergravity, but probably the right formula is to identify, say, the integer part of F5 with the number of brains. Okay, supergravity probably is not, because it's not fine enough to distinguish distinguish the integer part from the continuous part. Because, but I mean, I understand your question. And,
isn't it just the usual thing when we have a B field which is not necessarily quantized, that if from one and one charge gets shifted by it?
Yes, yeah, right. So maybe when you define it more carefully, it will become integer. Right?
But H is not
that. H is integer. H is certainly quantized.
Well, I think what Nikita's referring to is clear with H is 0. Your H is non-zero, so I think it's a little more.
Let me try to say why we think that N jumps. And N jumps, at first you have this flow of couplings, okay? And then if you just extrapolate these NSVZ beta functions, one of the couplings very soon hits a zero. And in fact, in supergravity, this cascade is infinitely fast. Okay, when G string M is very fast, this is all a smooth soup. Okay, this is why I think your question is hard to answer in the supergravity, because it's cascading like crazy, right? Because the steps between here are basically of order 1 over G string M. 1 over G string M.
We agreed that M was
M is very large, so the supergravity is valid when both G string N and G string M are very large.
So the cascade
is happening very, very rapidly. And I'm referring to the picture of a cascade which you can discern at finite coupling.
So but you're saying there's a granularity to the supergravity, and the spacing is below the granularity.
Right. Okay, so in field theory, I think this is a reasonable interpretation, because after you hit this infinite coupling point, you have to continue the flow beyond that. And then just what we noticed with Mads Trasler was just the application of basic Seiberg duality to the gauge group whose coupling diverged will turn it from SUN plus M to SUN minus M, and this group stays SUN, so it's as if indeed N became shifted by M, and this just keeps going and going, okay? In field theory, it's clear what's going to happen. If you have like N is say a million times M plus P, then it's going to stop by the time you get to SUP times SUM plus P, right? But the cascade has to stop. Now the problem with the solution is that it doesn't know anything about stopping the cascade. At some rate, because the function H is exactly logarithmic. Yeah, this particular solution.
But severity of the solution doesn't know anything about the jumping either.
No, it does.
It
just smoothed out the jumping, but you see the flow, the logarithmic flow of N. So you see that it's the jumps happen at exactly equal intervals, right? It's the same log that you would see here.
The bulk of this number between two jumps is should be large, but it can't be the problem. Because then it should not have super jumps. It means that you have.
No, but the derivatives of the fields are all small, but nevertheless, if you look at if you look at this formula, you know, there is this G string M squared times the log, right? So you look at how much distance in this log variable.
But the bubble distance also have H, you have So I think the probably something developed.
No, it's when G string, see, this jumps by M when G string M times log changes by 1, right? That means that the log R, that means
that. You have to plug in for the metric, but I can see the distance there.
No, I was identifying the log as literally the log in the field theory, okay? And the log has to change by something of order 1 over G string M to see this shift, which is a small...
Well, I'm trying to say that your answer to Alex's question was that supergravity is not sensitive enough because the jumps are occurring at small distances in supergravity. So supergravity, local distance between two jumps must be large.
No,
I think it's probably
just
order one.
Only one.
Yeah, maybe proper distance. Yeah, I think you're right. That the distance in this log variable is very small. Okay.
No, the proper distance in supergravity would go like log of r to the 5.5.
Oh, I forget. He's right that there is an extra G string M that blows up the whole thing. So.
But it doesn't appear any curvatures. It doesn't appear any curvatures or anything, does it? There are no curvatures which blow up.
No, no, the curvatures are very tiny. Yeah.
This is exactly why all of this must be
long. Yeah, I was just talking about the distance along the RG, from the point of view of RG, the natural RG variable.
Because supergravity itself is not enough.
Well, I don't know, maybe there is a better answer, but... but I don't think the supergravity can see the granularity of the... Okay. So basically, the final thought is that this solution is exact, but it's singular because this h of r function is the exact form of it in this solution, and it hits zero, at which point you find the naked singularity. So I think the solution is perfectly okay. It's actually smooth when log is sufficiently large. But when log hits zero in that neighborhood, it's certainly not smooth, and it has a blowing up curvature. So there is something wrong with the solution in the infrared. And so the idea is that as you resolve the singularity, you'll find that you need to deform the conifold. In other words, this ansatz where this T11 rigidly shrinks is not really sufficient to find a smooth metric. And you'll find that you need to replace this part of the metric by some other deformed metric, which asymptotically will give the same solution as this, but in the infrared will give a different solution. So this is the way in which geometry is telling us that chiral symmetry breaking should occur. It's telling us that there is this unacceptable singularity. Okay, so then I'll discuss the rest next time.